The Commandant, I notice, edges toward the stairs. Almost immediately she is flanked by my men, who halt her retreat. I want her to watch. I want her to witness her plan unravel. Avitas holds out one last torch, and I take it first to the southern part of the tower, near the sea, and then north, toward the war harbour. The heavy clank of channel chains dropping is audible even from here. From the war harbour, the last of the fleet, those 24 ships we didn't send out, emerges. None of the hundreds of plebeians watching from the bridge below could mistake the flags flying upon the masts. 2 crossed swords on a field of black, the original flag of Gens Veturia, before Caris added her foul K to it. Nor could anyone mistake the identity of the proud, white-haired figure standing at the helm of the lead vessel. Admiral Argus and Vice Admiral Vesalius are dead, I say to Caris. The fleet now answers to Admiral Quinn Veturius. Veturia men, true Veturia men, man the fleet, along with volunteers from Gens Atria. I know the moment that Caris Veturia understands what I've done, the moment when she realizes that her father, whom she had thought to be in hiding, has arrived, the moment that she realizes I have bested her. Sweat beads on her brow, and she clenches and unclenches her fists. The neck of her uniform is open, unbuttoned in agitation. I spot her tattoo. A.L.W. When she catches me looking, her lips go thin and she yanks up the collar. It did not have to be this way, Bloodshrike. The Commandant's voice is soft, as it always is when she is at her most dangerous. Remember that, before the end. If you'd just gotten out of the way, you could have saved so many. But now, she shrugs, now I will have to resort to harsher measures. A chill ripples across my shoulders, but I force myself to shake it off and turn to the black guards, all from allied gens. Get her to the interrogation cells. I do not watch them take her away. Instead, I turn to the paters. What did she offer you? I say. A market for your goods? For your weapons, Pater Tatius? And your grain, Pater Modius? For your horses, Pater Aquitius? And your lumber? Pater Lignius? War creates such opportunity for greedy, cowardly swindlers, does it not? Shrike, Avitas translates a drum message. Grimar turns his forces back. He's seen the attack on the ships. He goes to defend his fleet. It won't do any good. I speak only to the paters. The southern seas will turn red with the blood of the Corkans tonight, I say. And when the people of Navium tell this story, they will speak your names the same way they speak of the Corkans, with disgust and scorn. Unless you swear your fealty to Emperor Marcus Farrar and your loyalty to me in his place. Unless you get your men and yourselves onto those ships. I nod to the vessels emerging from the war harbour. And fight the enemy yourselves. It doesn't take long. Dex remains at the island to oversee the battle and get the plebeians back to safety. Avitas and I take the last ship out at my insistence. My blood rises, hungry for a fight, raring to have my revenge on those barbarian bastards, to pay them back for weeks of bombardment. I will find Grimar. I will make him hurt. Shrike! Avitas, who disappeared below decks, returns holding a gleaming warhammer. I found this at the Aquila Manor, he says, when I was checking through the supplies. Look. The black metal is emblazoned with 4 words I know well. Loyal to the end. The hammer fits in my hand as if I was born for it, neither too heavy nor too light. One end has a sharp hook to use for quick kills, and the blunt end is perfect for bashing heads. Before the end of the night, the hammer sees both. When the sky finally pales, only a dozen barbarian ships remain, and they all make a swift retreat south, with Quinn Veturius in hot pursuit. Though I hunted him, Grimar, the warlock priest, eluded me. I caught a single glimpse of him, tall and pale and deadly. He still lives, but not for long, I think. The shouts of the men of our fleet fill me with fierce joy. We won! We won! The Corkans are gone. Quinn will destroy those who remain. The plebeians backed me, and the commandant is imprisoned. The full extent of her treachery will soon be revealed. I arrive back at the Blackguard barracks, armor bloodied, warhammer slung across my back. The plebeians within give way, a cheer rising at the sight of me, Harper and my men. Bloodshrike! Bloodshrike! The chants propel me up the stairs to my quarters, where a missive waits, sealed with Emperor Marcus's sigil. I already know what it is, a pardon for Quinn Veturius, reinstatement as pater of his gens, and a new posting for him, as Navium's fleet admiral. I requested it days ago, via secret drum message. Marcus, after much convincing from Livia, granted it. Blood shrike! Blood shrike! Someone knocks on my door, and Avatos opens it to an ashen-faced Dex. My body turns to lead at his expression. Shrike! His voice is choked. A drum message just came in from Antium. You're to leave all unfinished matters and return immediately to the capital. The Empress, your sister, has been poisoned.
Chapter 29 Liar.
The past shall burn, and none will slow it.
The Nightbringer told me what was coming. He might as well have screamed his plans into my face, and I was too much of a fool to see it.
No, liar! Stop!
I barely hear the voice over the roar of flames in the refugee camp. I push through the crowds of gobsmacked mariners and scholars up toward the city. I could still make it to the library. I could still find the book on the Argas. Only the upper levels of the library burn. Perhaps the lower levels have survived.
What the hells are you doing?
Musa spins me around, face streaked with ashes and tears.
The mariners have left the refugee camp. They're heading to the library to try to save it. The scholars need help, Lyra.
Get Darin, I shout. And Zella, and Tore. I must get to the library, Musa.
Arpan. There are still scholars who...
When will you understand? The resistance doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is stopping him. Because if we don't, he sets the djinn free and everyone dies, including all those we've saved. His answer is lost in the panic all around us. I turn and run, throwing on my invisibility and cutting through the mariners pushing past the front gate. Hundreds of Adisa's residents pour into the streets, many watching the library burn, stunned. Others hoping to help. Fire brigade wagons scream through the streets, and soldiers unroll great snake-like hoses to pump water in from the sea. I fly past all of them, thanking the skies for my invisibility. By the time I reach the great library itself, blue-robed librarians stream from the front entrances, carrying books and scrolls and artifacts, pushing carts filled with priceless tomes. Many try to return, but the blaze spreads, and their countrymen hold them back. But there is no one to stop me, and I squeeze past the bottleneck of mariners who are escaping through the front doors. The lower levels of the library are a sort of controlled chaos. A mariner man stands atop a desk, bellowing orders at a small army of men and women. They obey as quickly and efficiently as if he were a mask, threatening whippings. I gaze up. Even the first level of this place is absolutely massive. A labyrinth with a dozen hallways branching every which way. What are the chances that a book on Arga prophecies would be on this floor? Think, Lyra. The mariners have been entrusted with the world's knowledge for centuries because they're careful and organized. Which means there must be a map around here somewhere. I find it carved into a plaque on the wall beside the head librarian. The library has more than 20 levels and so many types of books that my head spins. But just when I begin to despair, I spot
Martial History, Level 3. The stairs are emptier than the lower level. The librarians are not stupid enough to go to the upper floors. As I pass the second level, smoke fills the stairwell and flames crackle distantly. But the path is clear, and it isn't until I get to the third floor that I understand the extent of the fire. This level is half engulfed, but though the smoke is thick and the fire hungry, the shelves to my right are untouched. I pull my shirt over my face, my eyes already streaming, and hurry toward them, grabbing a book off the nearest shelf. Ankeny's Seers and the Lie of Foresight. I move to the next shelf, which has 1,000 books about the southern lands, and then to the next, which is all about the tribes. Scholar History, Scholar Conquest, Lacertian Marshals. I'm getting closer, but so is the fire. When I glance over my shoulder, I can no longer see the stairwell. The flames move faster than they should, and faces twist within them. Wind of Fritz. They use their power to fan the flames hotter, faster, to spread them. I crouch low, invisible though I might be. I do not know if they can see through my magic, like ghouls can. If they spot me, I am done for. The dull gilt of another book catches my eye because of its title. Always Victorious, The Life and Conquests of General Quinn Veturius. Elias's grandfather. I glance up and can just make out the plaque. Martial History. I scan the titles quickly. Everything on this shelf appears to be about generals and emperors, and I snarl in frustration. Would that Musa and I had gotten back to the city faster. Even 1 hour would have made all the difference, even 10 minutes. I'm close. So close. You there! A red-gowned woman appears behind me, deep scarlet tattoos winding up her arms. The silver and gold coins woven into her brown hair and strung across her forehead glow orange. My invisibility obviously doesn't work on her, because her pale, coal-rimmed eyes fix on me. Aja Duna. You are Laia of Sera. Her eyes widen in surprise when she gets a closer look at me, and I take a step back. She must have seen my face on the proclamations that Princess Nikla plastered all over Adisa. Leave here, girl. Quickly. The stairs are still clear. I have to find a book on the Argas, on their prophecies. You won't be alive to read it if you stay. She grabs my arm, and her touch immediately cools my skin. Magic. I notice then that the air around her is chilly and clear of smoke. The fire doesn't trouble her, despite the fact that I can barely breathe. Please, I gasp for air and sink lower as the smoke thickens. Help me! I need those prophecies! The Nightbringer! The Jaduna does not appear to be listening. She yanks me forcibly toward the stairs, but I dig my heels in. Stop! I try to wrench my arm away. The Nightbringer wants to set the djinn free! I babble, desperate for her aid, but she pulls me on, employing her magic, dragging me to safety with inexorable force. We Jaduna have no quarrel with the djinn, she says. Or the Meharia. His plans do not concern us. Everyone believes that nothing concerns them until the monsters are knocking on their doors. She winces at my shriek, but I do not care. Until they are burning down your homes and destroying your lives and killing your families. My responsibility is the Great Library, and that means getting you and anyone else who is in danger out. Who the skies do you think is to blame for burning this place down? Isn't that your responsibility? As I say it, the smoke parts and something white barrels toward us with a precision that suggests a malicious consciousness. Ifrit. Watch out! I tackle the Jaduna onto her back, cringing as the wind Ifrit passes so close that the skin on my neck stings. The Jaduna rolls out from under me, tracking the Ifrit with cold fury. She crooks her fingers, rises and streaks toward the creature like a comet, her gown turning ice white as she cuts through the flames and disappears. Immediately, I turn back to the shelf, but I cannot see it through the smoke. Gagging, I drop all the way to my hands and knees and crawl forward.
Liar.
Is the whisper in my head, or is it real? Someone in a dark robe kneels before me, peering down with bright eyes. It's not really the Nightbringer. If it were, I wouldn't be able to hold my invisibility. It's a projection of some sort, or ghouls playing tricks on me. But that does not lessen my disgust, or my fear.
You'll die here, choking on smoke, the Nightbringer says. Dead like your family. Dead for no reason at all. Beyond your own foolishness. I did warn you.
Liar! The image of the Nightbringer dissipates. The voice calling me is familiar and real. Darin, what the hells is he doing here? Immediately, I spin about, scrabbling toward his voice as he calls my name again. I find him at the top of the stairs, half of which are now engulfed in flame. Pleading fool! I dare not drop my invisibility for fear of blacking out again, but when I am close, I call out and grab his arm. I'm here! Go, Darin, go back! I have to find something! But my brother latches onto me and drags me down the stairs.
We both have to go, he shouts. The second level is gone!
I have to!
You have to live if you want to stop him!
Darin's eyes blaze. He uses all his force, and the third level is now a wall of fire behind me. We barrel down the stairs, weaving through blazing hunks of fallen masonry and an inferno of burning embers. I flinch as they land on my brother's bare arms, but he ignores them, pulling me down, down, down. A huge beam groans, and Darin only just lunges out of the way as it lands on the stairs with a thunderous crash. We are forced to go back up a few steps, and I inhale a lungful of smoke. My chest burns with pain, and I double over, unable to stop coughing.
Put your arm around me, liar, Darin shouts. I can't see you.
Skies, I cannot breathe. I cannot think. Do not drop the invisibility. Darin might not be able to carry you out of here. Do not drop it. We reach the second level, and the stairs are engulfed. Oh, bleeding hells, I am a fool. I should never have come here. If I hadn't, Darin would never have followed. Now we will both die. Mother would be so ashamed of me, so angry at my recklessness. I'm sorry, Mother. I'm sorry, Father. Oh, Skies, I'm so sorry. This is how Elias died. At least I'll see him again in the waiting place. At least I will be able to bid him farewell. Darin sees something I do not. A way through. He drags me forward and I scream. The heat on my legs is too much. And then we are past the worst of the flames. My brother carries me now, lifting me from my waist as my feet scrape against the ground. We burst through the burning front doors and into the night. Everything is a blur. I catch an impression of scaffolds and buckets and pumps and people. So many people. Blackness engulfs me, and when I open my eyes again, I am propped up against the wall of a side street, with Darin crouched in front of me, covered in ash and burns and sobbing in relief.
You are so stupid, liar! He shoves me. I must be visible again, for he hugs me, shoves me again, and hugs me a second time. You're the only one I have, the only one left! Did you even consider that before running into a burning building?
I'm sorry. My voice is hoarse, barely audible. I thought, I hoped.
Skies, the book. I did not find the book.
As the full impact of my failure washes over me, I feel sick.
The library.
It is gone, girl.
Darin and I both turn as a figure materializes out of the darkness. Dajaduna's beautiful red dress is scorched now, but she still exudes a physical chilliness, winter encased in skin. Her coal-rimmed eyes fix on me.
The Ifrits have done their work well.
Darin stands slowly, reaching for his sim. I drag myself to my feet beside him, leaning against the wall as dizziness makes the world tilt. The Jaduna will no doubt arrest us now, and there's no way we can outrun her, which means somehow I have to find the strength to fight her.
The Jaduna does not approach. She merely observes me for a moment.
"You saved my life," she says. "The Ifrit would have killed me. I owe you a debt.
Please, do not arrest us," I say. "Leave us be. That will be repayment enough."
I expect a retort, but she only watches me with that inscrutable gaze.
"You are young to stand so deeply in the shadow," she sniffs at me. "You are like him, your friend, the one they call Musa. I have seen him in the city, whispering his stories, using the sway in his voice to create a legend. Both of you, tainted by darkness. You must come to my home, to Kotama, in the east. My people can help you."
I shake my head. I cannot go east. Not when the Nightbringer is still a threat. The woman shakes her head, bemused.
"The Meheria?"
"You said that before," I say. "I do not know what it means."
"It is his name, Laya of Sera. His first, truest name. It defines all he has done and all he will do. His strength is in his name and his weakness. But," she shrugs, "that is old magic. The Nightbringer's vengeance has long been foretold. You would be wise to leave here, Liar of Sera, and go to Kotama."
"I do not care about Kotama." I lose my temper, forgetting that I am speaking to a woman who can probably kill in a dozen ways with a twist of her hand. "I have to stop him."
"Why?" She shakes her head. "If you stop him, do you not know what will happen? The consequence? The devastation?"
"I do not know how I will stop him now, in any case." The wind rises and screams echo from the street beyond. The fire is in danger of spreading to the city. The Jaduna frowns and looks over her shoulder before snapping her fingers. Something small and rectangular appears in her hands.
"Perhaps this will help."
She tosses it to me. It is a thick, heavy book with silver letters embossed on the side. A History of Seers and Prophets in the Martial Empire by Fifius Antonius Tullius.
"That," the Jaduna says, "is sufficient repayment of a debt. Remember my offer. If you come to Kotama, ask for Daju. She is the finest teacher in the Bay of Tears. She will help you control the darkness, lest it grow beyond your ken."
The Jaduna disappears. I open the book to find a gilded image of a man in a dark robe. His face is hidden, but his hands are bleached of color, and his red eyes look out from his shadowed cowl. An augur. Darren and I exchange a glance and then hurry away from the place before the Jaduna changes her mind. 2 hours later, my brother and I tear through Odessa's streets. I hope to the skies Musa is back at the forge, because I have no time to hunt him down in the refugee camp. Not now. Not after what I've just read. To my relief, the forge is lit when I go tearing in, and Musa sits in the main room, Zella tending to a burn on his arm. He opens his mouth, but I do not let him speak. "The Shrike survived an assassination attempt," I say. "Do you know how? When it happened? What the circumstances were?"
"Sit down at least."
"I need to know now, Musa." He grumbles and disappears into his room. I hear him rifling around and then returning with a stack of scrolls. I grab for one, but he smacks my hand.
"These ones are in code."
Long minutes pass as he reads one after another.
"Ah, here. She was stabbed by one of Keris's minions," he says. "One of her men transported her to the barracks. The Nightbringer was seen leaving her quarters, and 2 nights later she was back to issuing orders."
I flip the book about the augurs open to a page I've marked. "Read," I say.
The blood of the father and the blood of the son are harbingers of darkness, Musa reads. The king shall light the butcher's path. And when the butcher bows to the deepest love of all, night approaches. Only the ghost may stand against the onslaught. Should the lioness's heir claim the butcher's pride, it will evanesce, and the blood of 7 generations shall pass from the earth before the king may seek vengeance again. Curse the augurs. This makes no sense.
It does, I say. If you know that the shrike is a type of bird known for impaling its prey on thorns before it consumes it. I read it in a book once. People call it the butcher bird. That's where the name blood shrike comes from.
This prophecy can't be talking about her, Musa says. What about the other prophecy? The butcher will break and none will hold her.
Maybe that part hasn't happened yet, Darren offers. We're looking for a piece of the star, right? Do those reports say anything about the Bloodshrike wearing jewelry? Or is there a weapon she always has near her?
She has.
Musa rifles through the scrolls again before cocking his head and listening. One of his whites chitters swiftly.
A ring? Yes, she has the ring of the Bloodshrike, received in the fall of last year, when she assumed the office. And she has the ring of Jen's Aquila.
When, I ask, did she get that ring?
I don't bleeding, he cocks his head again. Her father gave it to her, Musa says, before he died. The day he died.
The blood of the father. It must have gotten on the ring when he died. And of course it would be her pride because it's a symbol of her family. And the Nightbringer, I say. He's been in Narvium all this time. I know the answer before Musa nods. Do you see now, Musa? I twist the armlet Elias gave me around my arm. The Nightbringer stayed in Narvium because his target was there the whole time. He never had to leave. She has it. The Blood Shrike has the last piece of the star.
Chapter 30. Elias.
Banu al-Ma'atha.
As I wander the city of the Djinn, a voice calls out, penetrating distantly, a hair-thin fishing line cast into an endless ocean. But I know who it is. Abarit Aranasur, the Fakira. I told her that if she needed me, she should come to the edge of the forest and call me. But I can't go to her, not with all that I now know. For I understand, finally, why Ma'atha forbids his soul catchers their humanity. Humanity means emotions. Emotions mean instability. Ma'atha's entire purpose is to bridge the world of the living and the dead. Instability threatens that. The knowledge brings me a strange sort of peace. I don't know how I will release my humanity. I don't know if I can, but at least I know why I should. Ma'atha stirs. The magic rises up from the earth in a dark mist, fusing into a tenuous vine. I reach for it. The magic is limited, as if Ma'atha doesn't trust me enough to give me more. I leave the city of Djinn, and am immediately confronted by a cloud of ghosts, so thick I can barely see through them.
Banu al-Ma'atha, help us!
The plea in Abarit's voice is audible, even from here. She sounds terrified. Sorry, Abarit. I'm sorry, but I can't.
Little one?
I startle at the ghost who has materialized before me, the wisp. She circles in great agitation.
You must come,
she whispers.
Your people fade, your family. They need you the way my lovey needed me. Go to them, go!
My family? My mind goes to the commandant, the marshals.
Your true family, the Desert Singers,
the wisp says.
Their pain is great. They suffer.
I can't go to them. Not now. I must pass the ghosts through, or they'll keep building up. The djinn will keep stealing magic, and I'll be stuck dealing with an even bigger problem than I already have.
Banu Al-Ma'atha, help us, please.
But if the tribes are in danger, I must at least try to see why. Perhaps some small act of mine can help them, and I can still return to the forest quickly and continue with my task. I try not to pay attention to the way the earth cracks behind me, the way the ghosts scream and the trees moan. When I reach the southern border, I bolster the wall with my physical magic to make sure no ghosts follow me and make for the distant glimmer of tribal wagons. Once I'm out of the waiting place, I hear a familiar tattoo. Martial drums. The closest garrison is miles away, but the echo is ominous, even from here. Though the drumbeats are too far away for me to translate, a lifetime of martial training tells me that whatever is happening, it's not good, and that it concerns the tribes. When I reach the camp, it has exploded in size. Where before there were only Tribe Nasur and Tribe Saif, there are now more than 1,000 wagons. It looks like a majilis, a meeting of the tribes, called only in the most dire of circumstances, which puts thousands upon thousands of tribespeople in one place. If I were a martial general attempting to put down any hint of insurgency and take slaves, this would be the perfect place to do it. Children scatter at my approach, hiding under carts. The stench is awful, sickly sweet, and I spot the carcasses of 2 horses left to rot in the sun, a cloud of flies buzzing above them. Did the marshals already attack? But no, if they'd been through here, they would have taken the children as slaves. To the north, I spot a circle of heart-stoppingly familiar wagons. Tribe Saif, my family. I approach the wagons slowly, wary of what I'll find. When I'm only a few yards away, a bizarre specter materializes in front of me. It's not human, I know that right away. But it's not transparent enough to be a ghost. It appears to be something in between. At first, I don't recognize it. Then its warped features become terrifyingly familiar. It is Uncle Akbi, the head of Tribe Saif and Mamie Rila's older brother. Uncle put me on my first pony at the age of 3. The first time I returned to Tribe Saif as a 5er, he sobbed and held me like I was his own true son. The specter shambles toward me, and I bring up my blade. It's not a spirit. What the hell's is it?
Elias Vittorios,
the strange half-ghost of my uncle hisses in Sadiz.
She never wanted you. What would she want with a squalling, pale-eyed thing? She only took you because she feared the evil eye upon her. And what have you brought but evil and suffering, death and ruin?
I recoil. When I was a child, I feared that Uncle Akbi thought such things, but he never said them.
Come, come and see what your failure has wrought.
The specter drifts to the Saif camp, where 6 tribespeople lie on cots in a row. They all appear to be dead, including Uncle Akbi. No, oh no! I rush to him. Where in 10 hells is the rest of Tribe Saif? Where is Mamie? How did this happen?
Banu Al-Ma'atha!
Abarit appears behind me, bursting into tears at the sight of me.
I have been to the forest 12 times. You must help us,
she wails.
The tribes have fallen to madness. There are too many.
What the bleeding hell's happened?
A fortnight ago, just after you left, another tribe arrived. They kept coming, one after another. Some had lost their fakirs, and all were struggling to move on their dead. The same struggle I had with my grandfather. And then, 2 days ago...
She shakes her head. Right when I disappeared into the forest.
The ghosts of the dead stopped moving on altogether. Their bodies will not die, and their ruh, their spirits, will not leave them. Even those with grievous injuries linger on. They are monstrous.
The fakira shudders.
They torment their families. They are driving their own kin to suicide. Your uncle was one of those. But you can see what has happened. Those who try to kill themselves also do not die.
A thin figure materializes from one of the wagons and throws herself in my arms. I wouldn't have recognized her had I not heard her voice, tired but still rich, still filled with story. Mamie? She has wasted away to nothing. I want to curse and rage at the frailty of her once strong arms, the gauntness of her once beautifully rounded face. She looks as stunned to see me as I am to see her.
Aberit Aranasur told me you dwell in the forest among the spirits, she says. But I did not believe it.
Mamie. Tradition demands that I mourn Uncle Akbi with her, that I share her pain. But there's no time for such things. I take her hands in mine. They are colder than I've ever felt them. You have to disperse the tribes. It's dangerous having them all here in one place. Do you hear the drums? From the mystified look on her face, I realize that she, and likely most of the rest of the camp, has not noticed the frenzy of martial activity. Which means the Empire is planning something even now, and the tribes have no idea. Aberit, I say. I need to find Afia.
I'm here, Banu al-Ma'atha.
Afia's formality stings. The tribeswoman shuffles toward me, shoulders slumped. I want to ask her how Gibran is, but part of me is afraid to find out.
News of your arrival spread quickly.
Get scouts out to all points other than the forest, I say. I think the marshals are coming, and I think they're going to hit hard. You need to be ready. Afia shakes her head, and her old defiant self appears.
How can we be ready when our dead won't die and we are haunted by their spirits?
We'll worry about that when we know what we're up against, I say quickly, though I have no idea what the answer is. Perhaps I am wrong, and the marshals are just carrying out drills. But I'm not wrong, and Afia knows it. She moves off quickly, and her tribesmen surround her as she begins giving orders. Gibran isn't among them. I consider the tribes. There are so many. And yet... Aberit, Mamie, I say. Can you get at least some of the tribes to head south, to scatter?
They will not go, Elias. Your uncle called a Majilis, but before we could have it, 3 of the other tribes' chieftains were driven mad by the spirits. 2 threw themselves into the sea, and your uncle...
Tears fill Mamie's eyes.
Everyone is too afraid to leave. They believe there is strength in numbers. You must do something, Banu al-Ma'atha,
Aberit whispers.
The ruh of our own people are destroying us. If the marshals come, all they will have to do is round us up. We are already defeated.
I squeeze her hand. Not yet, Aberit. Not yet. This is the work of the bleeding Nightbringer. He is sowing even more chaos by destroying the tribes. Destroying my friends. Destroying Tribe Saif, my family. I know it as surely as I know my name. I turn to the forest, reaching out to Ma'atha. Then I stop. Reaching for the magic to save the lives of people I love is exactly what Ma'atha doesn't wish me to do.
For us, Elias, duty must reign over all else. Love cannot live here.
I must curtail my emotions. My time in the Jinn City taught me that, but I don't know how. I do, however, know what it is to be a mask, cold, murderous, emotionless. Abarit speaks up.
Banu!
Silence! The voice is mine, but sharp and cold. I recognize it. The mask within. The mask I thought I'd never have to be again.
Elias!
Mamie is affronted by my rudeness. She taught me better. But I turn my face to her, the face of Caris Veturia's son, and she takes a step back before drawing herself up. Despite all that's happening, she's still a Kahani, and she will brook no disrespect, least of all from her children. But Arborit, perhaps sensing the storm of thoughts in my head, puts a gentle hand on Mamie's wrist, quieting her. Duty first unto death, Blackcliff's motto, which returns now to haunt me. Duty first. I turn my mind to Ma'atha again, but this time I consider. I need to stop the ghosts so that the tribes can move them on, so that I can return to the forest to do my duty. I want so badly for the magic to respond, for it to communicate with me, to guide me, to tell me what I should do. A child howls from nearby, a heartbreaking sound. I should go to him. I should see what's wrong. Instead, I ignore it. I pretend I am Shaver, cold and unfeeling, attending my duty because that is my only concern. I pretend I am a mask. Far in the forest, I feel the magic rise. Love cannot live here. I repeat the words in my head. As I do, the magic twines out of the forest, inching toward the mask in me, while still wary of the man. I harness that old patience the Commandant drilled into us at Blackcliff. I watch, I wait, calm as an assassin stalking a mark. When the magic finally seeps into me, I grab onto it. Abarit's eyes widen, for she must sense the sudden influx of power. The paradox of the magic tears at me. I need it to save the people I care about, but I can't care about them if I want to use the magic. Love cannot live here. Immediately, the magic fills my sight, and that which was hidden becomes apparent. Dark shadows cluster everywhere like malignant tumors in a tortured body. Ghouls. I kick out at those close by, and they scatter, but come back almost immediately. They congregate near the tents where Arborit and the other fakirs have put those who are afflicted. Relief sweeps through me, for the solution to this is so simple that I am angry I didn't see the ghouls before. You need salt, I say to Arborit and Mamie. Those afflicted by this malady are surrounded by ghouls who hold on to their spirits. Put salt around those who should be dead. The ghouls hate it. If you disperse those foul creatures, the afflicted will pass, and you should be able to commune with the spirits again. Arborit and Mamie disappear almost immediately to find salt, and to tell the other tribes of the antidote. As they sprinkle the salt around the afflicted, the hisses and snarls of thwarted ghouls fill the air, though I'm the only one who can hear them. I walk with the Fakira through the camp, the magic still with me, ensuring that the ghouls are not simply waiting for me to leave before slinking back. I prepare to return to the waiting place when a distant shout stops me in my tracks. Afia pulls her horse up beside me.
The marshals have mustered a legion, she says. Nearly 5,000 men. They're moving against us, and they're coming swiftly.
Leading hells.
The moment I think it, the moment my worry for the tribes rises, Ma'atha's magic leaves me,
I feel empty without him, weak. When will the marshals get here, Afia? Tell me they're a few days away. Perhaps if I wish for it, it will be true. Tell me they're still outfitting their troops, preparing weapons, readying for the assault. Afia's voice shakes when she answers. By dawn.
Part 3. Antium.
Chapter 31. The Bloodstrike. Avitas, Harper, and I do not stop to eat. We do not stop to sleep. We drink from our canteens as we ride, halting only to change horses at a courier's station. I can heal my sister. I can. If only I can get to her. 3 days into the journey, we reach Serra, and it is there that I finally stop, dragged bodily off my horse by Avitas, unable to fight back because of fatigue and hunger. Get off me! You will eat! Harper is equally enraged, his pale green eyes bright as he pulls me toward the door of the Black Guard barracks. You will rest, or your sister has no hope, and neither does the Empire. A meal, I say, and 2 hours of sleep. 2 meals, he says, and 4 hours of sleep. Take it or leave it. You don't have any siblings, I snarl. Not any who know who you are, anyway. Even if you did, you didn't watch as your family. You weren't the reason they... My eyes burn. Don't comfort me, I scream in my head at Harper. Don't you dare. Harper watches me for a moment before turning away, snapping at the guard on duty to get food and quarters ready. When he turns back, I am composed. Do you wish to sleep here in the barracks, Harper says, or in your old home? My sister is my home, I say. Until I reach her, it doesn't matter where I bleeding sleep. At some point, I fall asleep, half slumped in a chair. When I wake in the middle of the night, plagued by nightmares, I am in my quarters, a blanket tucked around me. Harper. He rises out of the shadows, hesitating at the foot of my cot before kneeling beside my head. His hair is mussed, his silver face unguarded. He puts a warm hand on my shoulder and nudges me back to the pillow. For once, his eyes are transparent, filled with concern and exhaustion, and something else I don't quite recognize. I expect him to lift his hand away, but he doesn't. Sleep now, Shrike. Just a little longer. 10 days after leaving Serra, we arrive in Antium, coated in sweat and grime from the road, our horses panting and lathered. She's still alive. Faris meets Avitas and me at Antium's massive iron portcullis, warned, no doubt, of our approach by the city guardsmen. You were supposed to protect her! I grab him by the throat, my anger lending me strength. The guards at the gate back away, and a group of scholar slaves mortaring a nearby wall scatter. You were supposed to keep her safe. Punish me if you wish, Faris chokes out. I deserve it, but go to her first. I shove him away from me. How did it happen? Poison, he said. Slow acting. Skies only knows where that monster got it from. Karis. This was her handiwork. It had to have been. Thank the bleeding skies she is still imprisoned in Navium. We usually wait 6 hours between when Livia's tasters test her food and when she eats it, Faris goes on. Either Raelius or I have overseen the testers ourselves. But this time, it took more than 7 hours for her tasters to drop dead. She'd only had the food in her for an hour, and we were able to purge her enough so that she didn't die immediately, but... The child? Alive, according to the midwife. The palace is calm. Faris has, at least, kept news of the Empress's poisoning close. I expect Marcus to be nearby, but he is at court, listening to petitioners, and isn't expected back in the royal quarters for hours. A A small mercy, but a welcome one. Faris pauses outside Livia's door.
She's not what you remember, Shrike.
When I enter my sister's room, I hardly notice her ladies-in-waiting, who wear expressions of genuine mourning. It makes me hate them a little less for being so very alive while my sister hovers near death.
Out, I tell them. Everyone, now. And don't bleeding say a word about this to anyone.
They file out quickly but reluctantly, looking back at my sister with sad longing. Livia always could make friends quickly. She treats everyone with such respect. When the women have finally left, I turn to Harper.
Guard the door with your life, I say.
No one comes in. I don't care if it's the Emperor himself. Find a way to keep him out. Avatar salutes, and the door is securely locked behind me. Livia's room is laden with shadows, and she lies as still as death in the bed, her face bloodless. I see no wound, but I can feel the poison twisting through her body, her merciless foe eating away at her insides. Her breathing is shallow, her color poor. That she survived this long in such a weakened state is a bleeding miracle.
Not a miracle, Bloodshrike.
A shadow steps from beside her bed, ink-cloaked and sun-eyed.
What are you doing here?
The Sky's Forsaken Djinn had to have known what the Commandant was doing. He might even have procured the poison for her.
You wear your thoughts openly, like you wear your blades, the Nightbringer says. The Commandant is not so transparent. I did not know of her plan, but I was able to hold your sister in stasis until you arrived. It is up to you now to heal her.
Tell me why you're helping me, I demand, enraged that I have to speak to him, that I cannot immediately begin to help Livy. No lies. Tell me the truth. You're Karis's ally. You have been for years. This was her doing. What game are you playing? For a long moment, I think that he will deny being a double agent, or that he will grow angry and lash me to bits. When he does finally speak, it's with great care.
You have something I want, Shrike. Something whose value you do not yet realize. But in order for me to use it, it must be given in love, in trust.
You're trying to win my love and trust. I will never grant it.
Your love, no, he says. I would not expect it in any case. But your trust, yes, I want your trust. And you will give it to me. You must. One day soon you will be tested, child. All that you cherish will burn. You will have no friends that day. No allies, no comrades in arms. On that day, your trust in me will be your only weapon. But I cannot make you trust me.
He steps back to allow me access to Livia. With one eye on the djinn, I examine her more closely. I listen to her heart. I feel her heart, her body, her blood with my mind. The Nightbringer did not lie about her. This poison is not one a human could survive without help.
You waste precious time, Bloodshrike, the Nightbringer says. Sing. I will hold her until she is ready to hold herself.
If he'd wanted to hurt me, truly hurt me, he'd have let her die. He'd have already killed me. Livia's song flows from my lips easily. I have known her since she was a baby. I held her, cuddled her, loved her. I sing of her strength. I sing of the sweetness and humor that I know still live within her, despite the horrors she has endured. I feel her body strengthening, her blood regenerating. But as I knit her back together, something is not right. I move down from her heart to her belly. My consciousness flinches back. The baby. He
And my sister is right, it is a he. Sleeps now. But there is something wrong with him. His heartbeat, which instinct tells me should sound like a gentle, swift thud of a bird's wings, is too slow. His still-developing mind, too sluggish. He slips away from us. Skies, what is the child's song? I do not know him. I know nothing about him except that he is part Marcus and part Livia, and that he is our only chance for a unified empire.
What do you want him to be?
The Nightbringer asks. At his voice, I jump, so deep in healing that I forgot he was here.
A warrior? A leader? A diplomat? His rue, his spirit, is within, but it is not yet formed. If you wish him to live, then you must shape him from what is there, his blood, his family. But know that in doing so, you will be bound to him and his purpose forever. You will never be able to extricate yourself.
He is family, I whisper. My nephew. I wouldn't want to extricate myself from him. I hum, searching for his song. Do I want him to be like me? Like Elias? Certainly not like Marcus. I want him to be an Aquila, and I want him to be a marshal. So I sing my sister Livia into him, her kindness and laughter. I sing my father's conviction and prudence, my mother's thoughtfulness and intelligence. I sing him Hannah's fire. Of his father, I sing only one thing, his strength and skill in battle. One quick word, sharp and strong and clear. Marcus, if the world had not ruined him, if he had not allowed himself to be ruined. But there is something missing. I feel it. This child will one day be emperor. He needs something deeply rooted, something that will sustain him when nothing else will. A love of his people. The thought appears in my head as if it's been planted there. So I sing him my own love, the love I learned in the streets of Narvium, in fighting for my people, in them fighting for me. The love I learned in the infirmary, healing children and telling them not to fear. His heart begins to beat in time again. His body strengthens. I feel him give my sister an almighty kick, and relieved, I withdraw.
Well done, Shrike. The Nightbringer stands. She will sleep now, and so must you, if you do not wish for the healing to ravage your strength. Stay away from any injured people if you can. Your power will call to you. It will demand to be heard, used, reveled in. You must resist, lest you destroy yourself.
With that, he fades away, and I look back at Livy, sleeping peacefully, the color returned to her face. Tentatively, I reach out a hand toward her belly, drawn to the life within. I keep my hand there for a long while, my eyes filling when I feel another kick. I am about to speak to the child when the curtains beside the bed rustle. Immediately I scramble for the warhammer strapped across my back. The sound comes from the hallway between Marcus's room and Livy's. My stomach sinks. I didn't even think to check that entrance. Shrike, you fool! A moment later, Emperor Marcus steps out from behind the drapes there, smiling. Maybe he didn't see me healing Livia. Maybe he doesn't know. It's been a few minutes. He couldn't have been watching that whole time. The Nightbringer would have seen him, sensed him. But then I remember that Marcus learned to keep the augurs out of his head from the Nightbringer. Perhaps he learned to keep the djinn out, too.
You've been keeping secrets, Shrike, Marcus says, his words dashing any hopes I had of keeping my magic to myself. You know, I don't like secrets.
Chapter 32 Liar. It had to be the Blood Shrike. It couldn't be some soft-handed courtier or empty-headed stable boy. Someone I could snitch the ring off of. How the skies am I supposed to get it from her? I pace in the courtyard of the smithy. The night is deep, and Tore and Sela have returned to the refugee camp to help, as the mariners have all but abandoned the scholars to the elements. Even invisible, I say. It'll be on her finger. She is a mask for Sky's sake, and if the Nightbringer is near her, I don't know if my invisibility will work. It will take me 2 months just to get to Narvium, but the Grain Moon is less than 7 weeks away.
She's not in Narvium, Musa says. She's headed for Antium. We can send someone who is already in the city to take it. I have plenty of people.
Or your whites, Darren says. What if they, a screeching chitter, disabuses us of that notion?
They won't touch any part of the star, Musa says after listening for a moment. Too afraid of the Nightbringer.
In any case, read it again. I nod at the book before him. Only the ghost may stand against the onslaught. Should the lioness's heir claim the butcher's pride, it will evanesce.
I'm my mother's heir, Musa.
You chose me yourself. And I'm the ghost. Who else do you know who can disappear?
If you're the ghost, Musa says, what's this business about you falling? Your flesh withering? Or am I remembering this shaver's prophecy wrong?
I hadn't forgotten. The ghost will fall, her flesh will wither. It doesn't matter, I say. Do you want to risk the fate of the world on trying to figure it out?
Perhaps I don't want to risk you, Arpan, Musa says. The refugee camp is a disaster. We have almost 10,000 homeless, another 1,000 injured. We need you as a voice for the scholars. We need you as our sim and shield. And we'll need you more if the Nightbringer succeeds. If you get yourself killed, you don't do me much good.
You knew this was the deal when you made it, I say. You helped me find the last piece of the star and take down the Nightbringer. And when I get back, I offer myself as leader of the Northern Resistance. Besides, if all goes to plan, the Nightbringer won't succeed.
The Marshals will still attack. Maybe not immediately, but it will happen. The Commandant has already tried to seize the Marshal Navy, as well as the Karkun fleet. She failed, but it's common knowledge she wanted those ships to take on the mariners. The Freelands need to be ready for war. And the scholars need a strong voice to speak up for them when that day comes.
It's not going to matter if we're all dead.
Look at you, Musa shakes his head. Half out the door, like you can just tear off for Antium this very instant.
The Grain Moon is little more than 6 weeks away, Musa. I have no time.
What do you propose? Darren asks. Liar's right, we have no time. Your face is known in the Empire. The Nightbringer can read your mind and your invisibility ceases to work around him. You need people to back you in Antium, Musa says. People who know the city and the Marshals. I can, of course, provide this. We let them come up with a plan to get you close to the Shrike. That way, it can't be picked from your mind.
And it can't be picked from theirs?
My people, well, person, is trained to keep out invaders. Mind like a steel trap, and as quiet and clever as a wraith. However,
no, however, I say, alarmed. Whatever you want me to do, I'll do it when I get back.
I've hardly asked anything of you yet, liar. Something tells me you're about to make up for that, Darren murmurs. Indeed.
Musa rises from his seat beside one of the forges, wincing as he does.
Come with me. I'll explain on the way. Though, he looks me up and down distastefully. You need to visit the bath first.
A sudden suspicion forms in my mind. Where are we going?
To the palace. To speak with the king.
4 hours later,
I perch upon an overstuffed chair in a palace antechamber beside Musa, awaiting an audience with a man I have no wish to meet.
This is a terrible idea, I hiss at Musa. We have no support from the refugees or the Adisan scholars. No resistance fighters at our backs.
You're leaving for Antium to hunt down a djinn, Musa says. I need you to talk to the king before you die.
Just because he knew my mother doesn't mean he'll listen to me. You've lived here your whole life. You have a much better chance of persuading him to help the scholars. Clearly he knows you, otherwise we never would have gotten this audience.
We got this audience because he thinks he's meeting the famed daughter of his old friend. Now remember, you must convince him that the scholars need aid and that there is at least a threat from the marshals, Musa says. No need to mention the Nightbringer. Just,
I understand. Since this is the 10th time you have told me, I do not add. I take hold of the neckline of my dress, low enough to show the K the commandant carved into me, and pull it up yet again. The gown Musa found for me is tight in the bodice and flows wide through the waist, turquoise blue silk overlaid with sea-green, gauze-like netting. The neck and hems sag with gold-threaded flowers, embroidered mirrors and minuscule emeralds. The net deepens into a dark royal blue at the hem, which just brushes the soft fawn slippers Tore gave me. I braided my hair into a high bun and scrub myself so hard my skin still smarts. When I catch a glimpse of myself in a mirrored wall of the antechamber, I look away, thinking of Elias, wishing he could see me like this, wishing he were beside me, dressed in his finest instead of Musa, and that we were walking into a party or festival.
Stop fidgeting, Apan. Musa draws me from my reverie. You'll wrinkle the dress.
He wears a crisp white shirt beneath a long, fitted blue jacket with gold buttons. His hair, usually pulled back, falls past his shoulders in thick, dark waves, and he has a hood pulled low. Despite it, more than one head turned as we walked with Captain Aliba through the halls of the palace. A few times, courtiers even tried to approach until Aliba turned them away. I can't do this, Musa. My worry drives me to my feet, and I pace the antechamber. You said we'd have one chance to convince the king to help us, that the future of our people depends on this. I'm not my mother. I'm not the right person. Boots clank beyond the door, and the entrance to the audience chamber opens. Captain Aliba awaits.
Good luck.
Musa steps back. I realize that he doesn't mean to come with me.
You get over here, Musa!
Liar of Sarah, Aliba announces in a booming voice. Daughter of Mira and Jahan of Sarah. She gives Musa a cold look. And Musa of Adisa, prince consort of Her Royal Highness Nikla of Adisa.
Only after my mouth has been hanging open a few seconds do I realize how foolish I must look. Musa shakes his head.
I'm not welcome here, Aliba.
Then you shouldn't have come, the captain says. The king awaits.
Musa remains a few paces behind me, so I cannot even glare at him properly. I enter the audience chamber, immediately awestruck by the soaring, jewel-encrusted dome above me, the mother-of-pearl and ebony inlaid floor, the rose quartz columns that glow with inner light. I feel suddenly like a peasant. An elderly man, who I assume is King Ermond, waits at the north end of the room. A familiar, much younger woman at his side, Princess Nikla. The thrones they sit upon are fashioned from enormous, weathered chunks of driftwood, ornately carved with fish, dolphins, whales, and crabs. The room is empty of anyone but the royals and their guards. Aliba goes to stand behind the king, her anxiety evident in the tap of her finger against her thigh. The king has the shrunken look of a once robust man who has aged suddenly. Nikla appears powerful beside her frail father, though nothing like the simply garbed woman I saw in the prison cell. Her heavily embroidered gown is similar to mine,
and her dark hair is arranged in an elaborate turquoise headdress that looks remarkably like a wave breaking on a shore. At the wrath in her face, my steps falter, and I search out any exits in the throne room. I wish I'd brought a weapon with me. But the princess merely glowers. She is not, I am relieved to see, surrounded by ghouls, though a few lurk in the shadows of the throne room.
Ah, my wayward son-in-law returns.
The old man's deep voice belies his frail appearance.
I've missed your wit, boy.
And I yours, your majesty. Moose's voice is sincere. He pointedly doesn't look at Aliba.
Liar of Sarah.
The crown princess ignores her husband.
Husband. Welcome to Odessa. Long have we wished to meet you.
Long have you wished to kill me, you mean? Hag. My irritation must show on my face because Musa gives me a warning glance before dropping into a deep bow. Reluctantly, I emulate him. The lines around Nicola's mouth tighten. Oh, skies, how can I speak to a king? I'm no one. How can I convince him of anything? The king gestures for us to rise.
I knew your parents, Liar of Sarah, he says. You have your father's beauty. Handsome as a djinn, that one. No fire in him, though. Not like the lioness.
Ermand looks at me with interest.
Well, daughter of Mira, you have a request. In honor of your late mother, who was a friend and ally for long years, I will hear it.
Princess Nicola barely suppresses a grimace at the words friend and ally, and her dark eyes glint. My ire rises as I think of the things she said about my mother, as I remember what children in the city were saying about the lioness. Nicola's stare bores into me, a challenge writ there. Behind her, something dark and furtive flits behind one of the rose quartz pillars. A ghoul. A reminder of the darkness we face, one that makes me square my shoulders and meet the king's gaze. I am not no one. I am Lyra of Sarah, and in this moment, I am the only voice my people have. The scholars suffer needlessly, your majesty, I say. And you can stop it. I tell him of the fire in the refugee camp, of all that the scholars have lost. I tell him of the Empire's war on my people, the Commandant's genocide, the horrors of Koth. And then, though Musa warned me not to, I speak of the Nightbringer. I am a Kehani in this moment, and I must make them believe. I do not dare to look at Musa until I finish the tale. His fists are clenched, knuckles white, gaze fixed on Nicola. As I told the story, my attention was on the king. I did not notice the ghouls emerging from the shadows and congregating around the princess. I did not notice them latching themselves onto her like leeches. Musa looks as if he is watching the slow torture of someone he loves, which I finally realize he is. Help the scholars, your grace, I say. They suffer when they do not have to. And prepare your armies, whether the Nightbringer comes or not, I say to the king. You must.
I must?
The old man raises his eyebrows.
I must?
Yes, I snap. If you want your people to survive, you must prepare for war. Nicola steps toward me, hand on her weapon, before controlling herself.
Do not listen to her father. She is nothing. Just a little girl selling stories.
Don't you belittle me. I step forward, and everything fades. Aliba's hand on her weapon, the guards tensing, a murmured plea from Musa to calm down.
I am the daughter of the lioness. I destroyed Blackcliff. I saved the life of Elias Veturius,
I survived Commandant Kerris Veturia. I survived the betrayals of the Resistance and the Nightbringer. I crossed the Empire and broke into Koff Prison. I rescued my brother and hundreds of other scholars. I am not nothing. I turn to the King now. If you do not prepare for war, Your Grace, and the Nightbringer unleashes his djinn, we will all fall. And how do we do that, Lyre of Sarah, without Serik Steel? Princess Nikla says. We know your brother still lives. Musa no doubt has him hidden away, hammering at weapons for your resistance.
Darin of Sarah is willing to make weaponry for the mariners, Musa cuts in smoothly, and I wonder when he talked to Darin about it. And to teach mariner smiths the trade. If an equal amount of weaponry is given to the scholars and an equal number of scholar smiths are taught, and if the scholars who have lost their homes are given temporary quarters in the city and employment.
Lies, Nikla hisses. Father, they seek to mislead you. They want only to arm their resistance. As much as I want to talk back, I make myself ignore Nikla. It's the king whom I must convince. Your Majesty, I say, it's a good offer. You won't get a better one. The Marshals certainly aren't going to help you. And how else will you get Serik Steel? The king observes me carefully now, and the sparkle of amusement in his eyes is gone.
You are bold, Lyre of Sarah, to tell a king what to do.
Not bold, I say. Just desperate and sick of seeing my people suffer.
I hear truth in your words, girl. And yet,
the king looks to his daughter, whereas without the ghouls she looked regal, even beautiful. Now she looks angry and merciless, her lips leached of color, her pupils overly bright. The old man shakes his head.
Perhaps what you say is true, the king says. But if we arm ourselves with Serik's deal, prepare our fleets, ready our defenses, the marshals could declare war by claiming we are planning an attack.
The marshals are in a constant state of readiness, I say. They can't attack you just because you do the same.